Okay, just before we start with our keynote address, I just want to make a couple announcements. We're here over lunch. We had in your packages and around, but I just wanted to reiterate a couple of things. Of course, our next major conference will be in exactly 4 weeks on Chassidut and spirituality right here at the Flyer. Four excellent speakers, like usual. We'll be coming. We'll again have a Saturday night panel right in here, and a program on Sunday will be a little bit shorter and a little bit less session. We won't have any double sessions, but that's the weekend of the 1st and the 2nd of December. Right here, it's in your packages. Take a look, and it's again an important subject. Really, was the talk of Rabbi Twersky's, talk in a sense, and we're going to expand on it and have a little bit of a focus on Chassidut, the modern day version, sort of the non-Chassidic Chassidut that has become like popular in certain places. Focus a little bit on women in Chassidut, the legacy of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So that's in 4 weeks. I'm sure many of you know, and I see some of you online, our electronic Torah in Motion e-team. The only announcement I'll make is that if you want to, come to some of the classes, you better, book quickly, because a number of them have been closed out already. We have people from Australia, Israel, England, about 20 states in the United States, all over the place. This is really an international learning thing, and I can tell you people who come on it are blown away. You sit in your living room, wherever you sit, and you watch, you see the speaker, you can talk to the speaker, you can write to the speaker. If you have a webcam, they can see you on screen. And a number of the classes have been closed out, but we'll be having new classes. A number have not. This Thursday night, Rabbi Riskin will be giving a class live, 9 p.m. Thursday night. Every Thursday we have a Parsha Shiur given by a different rabbi every Thursday night. So that's just the cute thing. The other ones are series. Menachem Leipag just has 4 to 5 seats left in the class, is starting this Saturday night, Midnight Midrash. We're actually starting 11:45, not exactly midnight, but after pizza, you can come, and after you go out on Sunday, you can come home and learn Torah at midnight till 12:30 a.m. On Saturday night, Sunday morning. Okay. And the last thing I just want to announce when we're here, this also has a limited amount of room, our second retreat. We ran the first one last year in February at the Sheraton, which we're doing again, this year. Rabbi Heshi and Ruki Billet, who are both wonderful speakers, will be here for the weekend, be at the Sheraton Hotel. It's a beautiful hotel. It was a very beautiful weekend last year. So if you'd like to come, let us know soon. If you book before the end of the month, it's $100 per couple off. But so that I highly recommend. It's a very nice, different weekend in the city, but away at the same time. I would just, before we introduce our guest speaker, Rabbi Angel, to give sort of the keynote lunch address, I just want to first thank and to briefly introduce Larry Krauss. I briefly mentioned last night that he has sponsored the conference since the beginning of Torah Motion. Torah Motion, really, our first program that got off the ground was the first Renewing Our Spirit conference 5 years ago. And Larry was the one who gave us the seed money, so to speak, to get us all started. And we owe him a tremendous debt of Hakarat HaTov. And he's been here every year to continue to sponsor the conference. We actually had it 2 years on the exact yahrzeit of his father, which he sponsors it in memory of, who unfortunately passed away as a young man. And but we always do it at this time of the year. It's the time of the yahrzeit. And I just want to invite Larry to say a few words and to thank him publicly on behalf of all of us. And as I mentioned last night, this year we have a second sponsor, Larry and Gary and Lisa Kaplan. I mentioned he said he was going to try to come, but they had their third baby boy Friday afternoon around 12 o'clock. And the oldest is about 4 and a half, and then he has a 2-year-old and now a baby. So I understand why I haven't seen him yet, but he may show up still. But anyways, I want to thank him, and I want to thank Larry and invite him to say a couple words.
Jay, Elena, and Elliot, I believe that I, on behalf of all of those present at today's conference, am expressing the feelings and sentiments of appreciation and gratitude to the three of you for once again organizing this year's wonderful conference and for assembling such a wonderful array of insightful speakers to address such relevant topics. And more than that, for doing this so tirelessly, or maybe not so tirelessly, on an annual basis and throughout the year, for our community and communities abroad, it's a wonderful thing to see how this has grown from that modest conference that we started 6 years ago. There is so much to learn, and we are grateful that you enable this process. I also wanted to collectively thank this year's formidable line of speakers for your openness and candidness, for your insight and experience in addressing the topics that we all grapple with. From the turnout here, you can see that we need this kind of event, this kind of process of renewal and chizuk. So thank you for your efforts that you have made to participate in this year's conference. I just want to add, and Jay alluded to it, that I just want to add that I hope that the merit of the learning that takes place at the conference, this conference today, contributes to the elevation of the souls of those to whom this conference is in memory of, Maurice and Sonia Ehrlich, and my father, Nota Kraus. So, yashu koach.
I believe I first davened in the Spanish and Portuguese shul in the fall of 1992. On a Friday night, I was almost engaged, I believe, and I was in the west side over Shabbos, and we decided to walk 69th Street, 70th Street, I'm sorry, and it was obviously a little bit of a different experience from I'm used to. It's a real Spanish and Portuguese shul, and it's a very, very nice experience. And a friend of mine from YU was actually the assistant rabbi at the time, who's now in Memphis. Joel Finkelstein was the rabbi at the time. We were together in YU, and that's, I guess, when I first davened in the shul that Rabbi Angel has so diligently and wonderfully served for. It's 1969, I believe. And as I heard before, I wasn't there, but I think it's an amazing thing. The shul was founded in 1654, and has a total of 8 rabbis. Since 1750, 8 rabbis. From 1768 to 2007, 8 rabbis. Rabbi Angel is the 8th rabbi. Work it out, okay? Do the math. I think that's a wonderful testament to the shul. That in itself really, really says it all. And what's extremely beautiful, his son Chaim Angel, has become the official new rabbi of the shul. His mother is here too, to chef in the naches. So we're very happy that Rabbi Angel was here over Shabbos with his wife at Rabbi Trotberg's, you know, shul. We missed him. That's another story. Anyway, so it's a pleasure to have you here. Rabbi Angel, in addition to being author of many, many books, in addition to his book on conversion, he writes a lot on Sparta culture. I read over the summer his book on Rav Chaim David Halevi. It's very, very interesting, and it really brings a world that many of us are unfamiliar with. The world of Psak Halacha, the Sephardi Psak Halacha, that's really developed in a slightly different way than Ashkenazi Psak Halacha, and it's a wonderful thing to be exposed to the multiple layers and interpretations of Judaism. Rabbi Angel served as the past president of the Rabbinical Council of America, which is the organization I belong to, that Rabbi Trotberg's belong to, and it's really an honor to have him here. And I want to introduce him to really give the keynote, you know, speech on where we're going, ideals and ideals in a postmodern world. And it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Jay, not only for introducing me so nicely, but really for running such a wonderful program. To you and Elliot and others who are involved in planning this, kol hakavod. We in New York have a lot to learn from you. Believe me. I'd like to say also a word of thank you to the sponsors, the hosts of the event. And more than anything, I want to thank each one of you for taking a Sunday and devoting it to studying Torah, studying important issues. Kol HaKavod. It's a wonderful feeling that we all share together in trying to understand our tradition. And thank you very much for adjusting to my 6'3" height. Yeah. I always believe that people should look up to a rabbi. Yeah. Okay, now can you hear me better now? There's a famous story that we read in the parasha last week about the story of Sodom. You know, there were very bad people there. Right? And in the rabbinic literature, the Midrash has the following story. Why were they so bad? What did they do that was bad? They had a special bed. And when people would come to town, if you were short, they stretched you to fit the bed. And if you were tall, which kind of concerns me a little bit, if you were too tall, they cut your legs off so you'd fit the bed. And that's why they were such bad people. I thought about that. Chazal are very, very smart. They don't just tell stories just for the sake of telling stories. They had something else in mind. And it seems to me what they had in mind was that the bed of Sodom symbolizes conformity. Not just that everyone should be the same physical size, but that everyone should think the same. Everyone should be the same. And their goal was to have a totalitarian society in which all the participants in that society would adhere to the authority, follow the customs and mores of that society, which happened to have been wicked anyway. And that is what they had in mind as the ideal. It struck me that this ideal of Sodom is antithetical to the ideals of the Jewish people. In the Talmud in Brachot, at the end of 58a, there's a wonderful little passage that tells us that when you see throngs of Jews, thousands and thousands of Jews, you're supposed to make a special bracha. Most of us don't have much occasion to give that bracha. But the bracha is Baruch Chacham Harazim. We praise God, who under so wise, he sees the root of each and every one of these people. When we look at thousands of people, we see a mass, a blur. We don't see their individual humanity. They're just a bunch of people. But God is so wise that he sees each and every person as he and she is. The Gemara says, their thoughts are not alike and their appearances are not alike. Our ideal as a Jewish people is to recognize the uniqueness of each individual, the razim, the sacredness, the individuality. Each of us is put on this earth for whatever reason. We have to try to figure that out. But each of us thinks differently. We look differently. We have different experiences. Different things affect us in different ways. We have different intellectual capacities, artistic capacities. Each of us has a unique set of ingredients that only we have. Nobody else in the whole world is just like any one of us. And our job in the Jewish tradition is that each one of us should make our contribution to the Torah. There was a discussion before in one of the previous sessions about Ma'amad Har Sinai, millions of people at Har Sinai. There's a famous statement quoted, attributed to the Ari HaKadosh, that the Torah doesn't have only 70 faces, but 600,000 faces. Or Rabbi Twersky will make it 3 million faces now. We'll enlarge it to include the women and children as well. But the Ari was trying to get across the point that the Torah's fullness is when everyone there has a different experience of the revelation, and cumulatively, when we put all of our experiences together, that is the revelation. None of us has all of it right. This particular notion that we each have something to say seems to go a little bit at odds with another principle in Judaism, namely authority. It means, yes, we all have our individual opinions, we all have our insights, we all have our way of thinking. That's all fine and good. But there's got to be boundaries to that. If every one of us does out his and her own thing, we have chaos. We have a lack of orderliness. So we also have to enforce some sort of boundaries of authority. There's always a battle in every civilization, and certainly within Judaism as well, to try to balance this tension between authority, boundaries, and at the same time respecting the individual's right to expression. If freedom becomes license, then you have a chaotic society. On the other side, if the dignity and sanctity of every individual is not respected, then we also have a very serious problem. So I'm not going to talk about the authority side today, even though it's an important issue, but I'm going to talk about the individual, the responsibility and right for individuals to express themselves and have the right to express themselves and not be fit into the bed of Sodom. And I want to begin this analysis with Maaseh Shehayah. One of my great heroes, as was mentioned, alluded to before, was Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, who served as the Sephardic Chief Rabbi of Tel Aviv for many years. He died in 1998. He was really one of the Gedolei Hador, unsung heroes of that generation. In 1984, my wife and I and family went to spend the summer in Yerushalayim, and I had started to study Rabbi Halevi's books in advance of that, and I wanted to meet him. So when we got to Yerushalayim, the first day I called his office in Tel Aviv, Rabbi Halevi, I'm from New York, I'm a visitor, I'm a rabbi, I would like to meet you. Please, by all means, come. So I came to him, and my wife says, when I came back from that meeting, she says, Mark, it looks like you just met a movie star. I was glowing, you know, I mean, this great personality or sports figure, some outstanding person. But to be in Rabbi Halevi's presence was so elevating, and so I'm an angel, I must have developed a halo just from that particular experience. So after my meeting with Rabbi Halevi, I said before I was going to leave, I said, I'm going to be in town in Israel for another month or so. I want to come to your shiurim. Wherever you give a shiur, I want to come, I want to hear you. I want to be able to spend time learning Torah from you at any shiur you give anywhere. And his face kind of gets serious. He says, Angel, I don't give shiurim. I said, what? And there's no, a rabbi doesn't give shiurim? How is that possible? You can't. Does a cow give milk? Yeah, a tree give apples? You have to. What do you mean a rabbi doesn't give shiurim? I said, Rabbi Halevi, I don't understand. How is it that you don't give shiurim? I'll tell you. Previous year, he gave a lecture at Bar Ilan University for Dayanim and Rabbanim in Israel. And the subject that he chose to talk about was allowing civil marriage in Israel. That was in 1983, a long time ago. He always was way ahead of the curve on everything. And he didn't say that they should adopt that policy, but he said, as serious rabbis, given our population in Israel, that so many people are not religious, and so many people may get married by the Rabbanut, but then when they get divorced, they don't bother getting a get, and then they remarry. There's so many issues, it might be a good idea to consider other options for marriage in Israel, other than just having Orthodox rabbinic marriages. He said, Rav Angel, after that meeting, people came and hugged me and kissed me. Thank you for saying so. Thank you for opening up the issue. Thank you for being so open. And he felt very good about it. And then the same exact people walked outside, and there's the press, newspapers and TV and the radio. But do you hear about how there'd be a statement about the allowing or considering open civil marriages? Yes. Well, what do you think about it? It's terrible. It's horrible. It's a chilul Hashem. It's going to destroy the Rabbanut. It's going to destroy holiness in Israel. All the guys who gave him hugs, when they went outside, their knives were sharpened to stab them straight in the back. Okay, they're entitled to their opinion. Or they were worried about their jobs or whatever it is. Next Monday night, Rabbi Halevi goes to give a shiur. He used to give a shiur every Monday night in one of the synagogues. He always had 200, 300 people coming to his shiurim. That night he goes, there are 10 people there. He's very surprised. Next week he goes, there are 8, 9 people there. He's amazed. So he calls up his regular chassidim who come to his classes. Where are you? They say, we were told we can't come to your shiurim anymore. Rabbi Halevi said, who told you? We were told. He said, in this exact quotation, Rav Angel, Atasha mata ala mafia, yesh po mafia. Have you heard of a mafia? There's a mafia here. You don't talk the party line, you're out. They completely isolated him all of his life, who was really one of the Gedolei Hador. He still spoke in many contexts, but not in any yeshiva, and not within the so-called yeshiva world community. He told me at the end, my yeshiva are my books. Read my books. Have other people read my books. That's my yeshiva. I told him, Rabbi Halevi, I'll go out and raise money. Start a yeshiva. In your tradition and the tradition of Rabbi Uziel. He said, I'll start the yeshiva and no one's going to come to it. It's not right here. The society is so warped when it comes to these subjects, they won't let people come to my yeshiva. My books are my yeshiva. This is Maaseh Shehayah. I'm not making any of this up. So what's sad about that? That we heard a very pious, good man that he felt hurt, that is very sad. But there's something more sad. A person isn't allowed to express an unpopular opinion in a civilized, decent way and receive civilized and decent criticism. Rabbi Halevi never said, kablu dati, this is what the truth is, you must accept it. He gave an opinion, and he based it on good, solid reasoning. And if there was a rabbi there who didn't agree, he should say, respectfully, Rabbi Halevi, I disagree, and here's the reason why, A, B, C, D. Or here's the reason I may agree with your points, but there are other considerations that you missed. Aren't we entitled to have intelligent discussion among ourselves, a difference of opinion? Or is there a thought police? Is everyone supposed to fit into the bed of Sodom? This is a very deep indictment, not just for those rabbis or people that gave Rabbi Halevi a hard time. It's an indictment of what's going on in Orthodox life in general. And I'll give you other examples. You all have your own examples. I've been a rabbi for many years. I've been very active in the Rabbinical Council of America and Rabbinical Alumni of Yeshiva. And I've been chairman or co-chairman or on the committee of many, many conferences. And we sit around the table, the committee, to decide who are we going to invite to speak on such and such a subject. So we say, we want to have this particular topic discussed. And you know who's good at that? Rabbi so-and-so. That's not his real name. Another person at the table says, we can't invite that rabbi. Why not? Because if we invite that rabbi, Rabbi X won't come to the convention. Just a second. So I say, Rabbi X, who isn't even here, he has veto power over who we could invite? The answer is really yes. There's subtle and not so subtle, insidious attempts to limit who's kosher and who's not kosher, whose opinions are valid and we can accept and we can listen to, and whose opinions we shouldn't even hear. Now, I'm in favor of people saying things even if they're false, even if they're wrong. I really do believe in freedom of expression if people are intelligent and have something to say. And I also believe, just as people can express their opinion, we have a right to say that they're wrong. And we have a right to prove that they're wrong. Just because people say things doesn't mean it's correct. But I cannot tolerate, that's why I'm intolerant, the structure or the religious structure that says we don't allow people to express their opinions. God is Chacham HaRazim. We don't follow the Bed of Sodom model. We follow the model that respects individuals. And each of us brings something to the table, if it's right or if it's wrong. Sometimes, in the course of my career, it may be true in other people's career. Sometimes I've been in a room and someone has said something that I consider to be very stupid, unfounded, irrational, crosses the line. But it made me it triggered thought in me. It made me figure out an answer to that question. It made me try to think through the process, rethink. It opened my brains again to a new process of reevaluating something I took for granted. And I will conclude that person really is stupid. He really said the wrong thing. But I can only say that again after reprocessing it and thinking through the issues. But I found over the years that some people have said things that are very off the wall and really struck me wrong. And after reanalyzing it, I said, hey, maybe there's a point there. Maybe I simply overlooked it myself because of my own closed mind and I wasn't open to the fact. Each of us has one bit of light of Torah in us that only we got and nobody else got. No one else has it. And therefore, we have the obligation to put it on the table and let people analyze it. Take it, don't take it, but each of us has to share. If we're deprived of that right, that essential freedom, then not only are we hurt as individuals, but the Jewish people as a whole suffer. We are all diminished by it. There's a discussion in the Shulchan Aruch, if a student has the right to disagree with his teacher. So, in the Shulchan Aruch, the Ramah says, a student is allowed to disagree with his teacher as long as he does it respectfully and as long as he has proper proofs. And there's quite a bit of discussion in the halakha, in halakhic sources, what extent a student can disagree with a teacher. So there's a very famous teshuvah of Rabbi Halevi, who I'm quoting again. Rabbi Halevi had the following question. There was a rabbi who had to deal with a case between A and B. And this rabbi thought about it very carefully. He did his research, he did his homework. He said, A is correct. So Mr. B, in typical style, goes to find another rabbi. Didn't want to lose a case. So he went to another rabbi who was even a bigger, greater rabbi than the first rabbi that they brought their case to. And the second rabbi, a bigger, greater, older rabbi, said, no, you are right, and the first rabbi made a mistake. So Mr. B goes back to the first rabbi and says, you know, Rabbi, you said this, but I went to Rabbi so-and-so who's better than you and bigger than you and more famous than you, and he says, I'm right, and you're wrong. So this first rabbi says, oh, just a second, let me think about it. Let me go through the sources again. Let me hear that person's objections. Let me hear the person's arguments. And the fellow went through the whole thing from top to bottom again. And at the end, he concluded, he still writes. So he wrote to Rabbi Halevi, what am I supposed to do? I've gone through this thing carefully. I've thought about it. And I know I'm right. On the other hand, this other rabbi is greater than I. I'm not saying no. He's greater. He's better known. He's one of the Gedolim. He's right. Should I just defer to that other rabbi? So Rabbi Halevi answered, if the question came to you, you have the responsibility to answer it to the best of your ability. You have the responsibility to understand all the criticisms that are put against your arguments. You have the responsibility to know why you might be wrong. But if after all the homework is done and all the research is done, you're still sure you're right, you must paskin, he didn't use the word paskin, you must give up sak, exactly the way you think it's supposed to be. And if you defer to the greater authority, without really agreeing with them, but you defer because he's a greater authority, hare ze din sheker, you're guilty of giving false judgment, which is a serious indictment for a judge. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein had a certain question. He disagreed with Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, who was certainly a great rabbi. And he said, I apologize to Rabbi Kluger, but our most important thing is the pursuit of truth. These are great poskim. These are people who understand, when we try to understand reality and try to understand a psak and try to understand what God's will is, we need to pursue truth with a ruthless honesty, with an openness to other opinions, and be deferential to authority, but not cowed by authority. To be able to recognize you have responsibility and you have to make judgment. The problem with that particular philosophy is, if you make a judgment and it's not a popular one, then other people try to invalidate you. They marginalize you. I'm sure that never happens here in Toronto. But how come you're laughing? There's a famous teshuvah in the Tziv, Meshiv Davar number 44. He says as follows, it is not difficult to imagine reaching the situation in our time, heaven forbid, that if one of the faithful thinks that a certain person does not follow his way in the service of God, then he will judge him to be a heretic. He will distance himself from him. People will pursue one another with seeming justification, beheter dimyon, heaven forbid, and the people of God will be destroyed. What is happening in our Orthodox world? Certainly, mostly we're perfect, no question. And I don't want to rag on Orthodoxy. I love Orthodoxy. I am Orthodox. But in some circles, and I think it affects all of us in one way or another, and I think we have to face up to it, is that there is an attempt to discredit people who have opinions that aren't the party line. And the power of authority is getting narrower and narrower. The number of legitimate voices becomes fewer and fewer. I want to give just maybe a couple examples thereof. A simple thing, it's very trivial. The National Council of Young Israel sent out a notice not too long ago, and they said, up until now, they trusted their congregations to hire rabbis. Now they say, you can't hire rabbis anymore without them first going through our Vat Halacha. We'll decide if a candidate is kosher to apply to your synagogue. It's a small thing, trivial. What is really happening? What's happening is, we used to trust the public to have some degree of judgment and responsibility. If a synagogue wants to hire a rabbi, they should have brains to know if this person is religious enough or smart enough or lamdan enough. They should know if this person qualifies or doesn't qualify. And they should have they've done it well for the last 100 years, I hope. They've done it. Now suddenly a group comes and says, you know what? We don't trust you anymore. We don't believe in you. We want to create some kind of bed of Sodom. We want one uniform standard, and we'll decide what that standard is, and we'll decide who can come in through the door and who can't come through the door. The chances are it'll affect very few rabbis. The one rabbi I was told that it actually did affect, that shul pulled out of the Young Israel rather than give up their rabbi. Kol hakavod. But the point of the matter is, that's one example of a phenomenon which is constricting authority. I'm not going to go through this again, but we had that discussion in a previous session about the conversion issue, where the Rabbanut in Israel is saying, from now on, we're not letting all rabbis in the Gola, Orthodox rabbis, do conversions. We want to constrict that authority. We're going to limit the number of people who have access to power, and we'll decide what the rules are, letting people through the door or not letting them through the door. On the one hand, there may be some sense to all these policies. On the other hand, the long term, as far as I can see, that these policies are inimical to the best interests of the Jewish people. They show a disrespect for the individuality and the responsibility of each of us, whether we're laymen or whether we are rabbis. Rabbi Chaim Palachi was one of the great rabbis in the 19th century Izmir. He wrote as follows in his Chikkei Lev. He says, "The Torah gave permission to each person to express his opinion according to his understanding. It is not good for a sage to withhold his words out of deference to the sages who preceded him, if he finds in their words a clear contradiction. A sage who wishes to write his proofs against the kings and giants of Torah should not withhold his words nor suppress his prophecy, but should give his analysis as he has been guided by heaven." We have a responsibility, not just rabbis, but laymen, all thinking people. We have a responsibility to our own souls to be able to express our opinions. Not foolish opinions, not ill-thought opinions, but carefully reasoned opinions. We have a right to put our ideas in the public forum. Other people have a right to accept or disagree with them. But once we are told we're not legitimate to talk, once we're told you can't be at a convention because if you go, the other rabbi won't show up, once we're told this one is kosher, this one isn't kosher, or this idea is acceptable, this idea is not acceptable, the whole enterprise collapses. And we enter not a world of freedom, but a world of tyranny. And I hate to use that word, but that's exactly what it is. Orthodoxy needs to foster a love of truth. We need to foster a spirit of inquiry, of openness, of tolerance. We need to welcome differences of opinion, whether we agree with those opinions or don't agree with the opinions. We need to recognize that diversity isn't against authority, but diversity gives authority its very basis. We need to be able to find sources not only among a small group of rabbis who live in one part of the world, but among rabbis who live all over the world at all times. I'm particularly sensitive on this question because great Sephardic poskim simply are left to catch dust, even though they have very much to say to issues of our concern. Our schools and our institutions must foster diversity of discussion. That's one of the reasons Torah in Motion, I think, is such a powerful enterprise. And all of you who support Torah in Motion are doing your share in trying to open up the dialogue and open up the discussion. Kol HaKavod. We must remind ourselves and remind everyone else we are not going to be confined to the bed of Sodom. We are not going to quash our individual lives. We're not going to quash our creativity, and we're not going to be silenced. And if people try to silence us, we'll find other ways of conveying what we think is important for the Jewish people to know about. Let me go to another question related to this. Authoritarianism has become one of the hallmarks of orthodoxy. I don't say authority. We have to have authority. There has to be authority. There is a certain hierarchical thing. I know more than some people. Some people know more than me. And it's very good that we consult with people who know more and have responsibility, greater responsibility. That's fine. There's nothing wrong with authority. But there is something wrong with authoritarianism. If people say, "Listen to me," I say, "Yes." Why? Because I said so. I don't accept that. If they could convince me, if they could give me the argument and prove that what they're saying is sensible, then I could accept that. And very often they can. But when people try to rule by authoritarianism and say, "You must listen to me because I'm a gadol," or because I'm Rabbi XYZ, or because I'm so-and-so. No, not for me. I'm an American citizen. I believe in freedom of speech, and Canadian citizens believe it as well. And a Jew believes it. We were created with our individuality. We have the right to express ourselves. There was a recent convention of rabbinical council where one of the Rosh Yeshiva came and spoke. And he said, "The role of a synagogue rabbi is to make shalom. Make peace, be pastoral. Make peace, comfort people when they're mourning, cheer them up when they're getting married. Make peace. But when it comes to questions that are hard, you come to me." No. Not acceptable. That's the wrong advice. That's the wrong message to be giving to Orthodox rabbis and to the Orthodox community. Yes, when there are tough questions, I can't answer them. I don't claim I could answer all questions. I do go to people I think know more. But it's my judgment to pick who I go to and then to process what they teach me, and still I have to make the conclusion myself. Right, wrong, or indifference. That's the responsibility God gave me. And if a rabbi doesn't have the gumption to do that, he shouldn't be a rabbi. He should become a taxi cab driver. Something else. If you take in the responsibility to lead a congregation and a community and to answer their questions, you are their doctor in spiritual things. You must take that responsibility and not back away from it. There's another thing. When there's authoritarianism, a byproduct of it is conformity, not just in the way we think, but conformity in the way people dress. There's a religious look, and there's a not religious look. If you wear this, you're one kind of religion. If you wear another kind of hat, you're another kind of religion. If you wear a black hat, where you sit in or you wear sit out, these are all expressions of certain religiosity. Ladies and gentlemen, those aren't expressions of religiosity. Those are expressions of societal pressures, wanting to blend in with this society or that society. I don't think God, when he gave us the Torah at Sinai, we were all there, so I hope you remember, he didn't say, in order to look religious, you have to wear tzitzit out. Sephardim never wore their tzitzit out. Until the modern time, they got influenced by Ashkenazim. But that wasn't our thing. And all Jews in all places didn't wear black hats. And they were still very pious and very religious. And people have worn all kinds of garbs over the centuries. And have been fine, God-fearing, and God-loving people. But the trend towards conformity is very, very great and very powerful. I'll give you one sad case of conformity. There are many of them. And again, I speak from perspective of as a Sephardic rabbi. A member of our congregation, a Moroccan background, went to Israel recently because their family republished one of the Sefarim that was written by their great-grandfather, great rabbi from Morocco. And in the room, the whole family got together. One of the people there was his first cousin who learns in a yeshiva in Israel, an Ashkenazic yeshiva. And the guy, of course, comes dressed just with black hat, black coat, tzitzit out. Okay. That's not how they did it in Morocco, but that's how they do it in Mir Yeshiva. It's the Mir Yeshiva. Yeah. So, when they were talking, the cousin tells the member of my synagogue, you know, my name isn't blank anymore, the name of the family. I changed my name. You changed your name? Why? It's such a beautiful name. We're here to celebrate our great-grandfather. In the Mir Yeshiva, when I use that name, people look down on me. People look down on you because you have a beautiful name that, and your great-grandfather was a great Tamish Chacham. You don't fit into the mold. You don't fit, you're out. I want to fit. You want to fit? Forget who you are. Sell your soul out. Put on their clothes, wear their hats, speak their language. Don't be yourself. Bet of Sodom in operation. And I can repeat the same story affecting 1,000 different people that I know personally. It's an outrage. It's a scandal. It's not tolerable. Go and buy, in the olden days, you wanted to buy something kosher. So you go to the supermarket, you find something that says OU. That's fine, good, buy it. Now you go to the supermarket, you have OU, ba-ba-ba, you have 5 hashgachot on every cookie. Where did it come from? Why do we have so many hashgachot on all the cookies? The answer is, some circles don't accept the OU, and some circles don't accept Satmar, and the Chabad certainly don't accept them, so you have to hashgachot from everybody to make it look good. Is that good for the Jews? Are we nuts? We can't decide what to eat. I have a man in my synagogue who's a manufacturer, was a manufacturer. He used to manufacture steel wool. And before Pesach, he used to have mashgichim come to give hashgacha for steel wool, because he has soap in it. And he had the exact same process, and he had to hire 10 mashgichim from 10 different agencies to watch the same exact run and all put their own stamp on the. Good point. That's one of the mashgichim must be angry at me for telling the truth. All right. The point of the matter is, in Israel, you have hashgacha. What's the best hashgacha in Israel? He says badatz. Beautiful. Should be the Rabbanut. The Rabbanut has a monopoly on kashrut in Israel. It's funded by the government. And people, the Rabbanut, I'm not sure I can eat there or not. They're good enough to pashul or gerim, but they're not good enough to give me kosher food. But the rabbi says very wisely, badatz. Who is badatz? The Beit Din Tzedek of the Eidah HaCharedit. Well, go read a book about the Eidah HaCharedit. You know what? These are anti-Israel people. They hate Israel, the state of Israel. They hate the government of Israel. This is really very heavily Satmar. Every time you buy a box of cookies in Israel, you're supporting Satmar Hasidim. Let them live and be well. But in the state of Israel, to consider the best Hashgacha, every time we buy an item, practically speaking, we're supporting a movement, a group of people that by ideology oppose the state of Israel. Do we really want to do that? But we do that. There was an advertisement for the Ramada Renaissance Hotel. We were in Israel this summer. By the two best hashgachot in Israel, the Badatz and OU. No Rabbanut there. Who's OU in bed with? the badans. What's happened to us? Why don't we have judgment? Why, as consumers, why don't we object to it? We don't. Badats is frumer. They have longer beards. They're more pious. Whatever the story is, they hate us. Not us personally. They love us as people, I hope. But they hate our ideology. They hate the state of Israel that we support. Let me go to another thing. Conformity in thought leads to another kind of conformity. What's acceptable to say and what's not acceptable to say. And what often happens, in my experience I found, that people tend to understand Judaism and religion in the most simplistic ways. They quote Chazal, who were great geniuses, great brilliant minds. They quote them as though they were not very smart people. The Rambam already criticized people who took the words of Chazal literally when those words contradicted reason or contradicted science. The Rambam said anyone who supports the words of Chazal against reason and common sense is discrediting Chazal because they're making Chazal seem like fools. Chazal were not foolish. If they said something, there must be deeper meaning in it. Let me give you exact cases that happened recently. One young man, aged 10 or 11, 11-year-old kid, was in a modern Orthodox day school in New Jersey. Goes to school, and the teacher teaches a wonderful lesson. The lesson is that there never was such a thing as a dinosaur. So the kid raises his hand, and says, on Sunday we went to the Museum of Natural History. I saw dinosaurs. The museum was full of dinosaur bones. The teacher says, without blinking, you did not see dinosaur bones. What you saw were dog bones that got swollen in the flood of Noah. Very inventive, very creative. This kid comes home and then tells the mother. The mother is outraged. She goes to the principal and says, look what you're being taught in your school. And the principal says, that's in my school? Yes. What can I do? I can't find any better teachers. These are the ones who come. They come from these yeshivas or seminaries. They don't get much of a sophisticated education. They hear something. Yes, those people are educating our kids. I spoke in Cornell University a couple years back. And I met a fellow who is now a religious Jew, but for the previous 20 years was totally not religious. And he was not religious. He became not religious when he attended Cornell as a student. Why did he become not religious? Because he took classes, and he learned that there were dinosaurs. And he learned that the world was more than 5,760-something years old. And when it hit him that what he was taught in school was wrong or not scientifically verifiable, the hit was so strong, he said, if they told me that wrong, everything else must be wrong too. So he threw everything out. And it took him 20 years to come back. Arya Kaplan has a beautiful article about the age of the world. In that article, he quotes Rabbi Isaac of Akko, who was a great Kabbalist and a teacher of the Ramban. Isaac of Akko, knowing no science whatsoever, just based on Midrashim and rabbinic statements, did calculations that if you calculate them out, as Rabbi Arya Kaplan did, proved that the world was 15.3 billion years old. Pretty much what science is saying now. Very close. When Isaac of Akko said that, no one said, oh, he's an Apikores. He's crazy. He's terrible. No. Because we had a bigger mind. We were not so fixated on these kind of things. We had a broader way of understanding reality. Let me give another example. A couple years back, our grandson comes home from school with pictures he drew about the Megillah. So he does pictures, and there's a picture of Mordechai and a picture of Esther, a picture of Vashti. And if you look at Vashti, she has pimples and a little tail. So we asked our grandson, why did you draw Vashti in such a funny way? That's what our teacher taught us, that Vashti had pimples and a tail. So my wife, who's a teacher in the same school, goes to the teacher, why did you have him draw that picture? So Vashti did have green pimples and a tail. That's what I learned. So my wife asked, does it say that in the Megillah? She said, I think so. It doesn't say so in the Megillah. It doesn't say anything about Vashti at all, except that she very little about Vashti. You would never know. The Midrash makes good people good and bad people very bad. They try to make Vashti into a descendant of Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a wicked person, so they wanted to show that Vashti had no merits. So they make fun of Vashti. It's a poetic, midrashic way of dealing with it. But it's not literally true. So now the little kid grows up thinking Vashti's this way. He grows up and he looks at the Megillah and he says, hey, there's no story about Vashti with a tail. If my teacher told me that fairy tale, maybe everything else is a fairy tale. How can I distinguish? And a lot of kids who grow up and get turned off from Judaism because what they learned in the first place is wrong and not defensible. And we heard a case like that last night. And one last example. relating to the parasha that we just had about Rivka. Last year, this parasha, a member of our synagogue, he went on Aliyah to California. He lives in California now. And he went to shul last year for this parasha, and the rabbi made a drasha, and he said, when Rivka brought the camels to feed to give water, how old was Rivka? 3 years old. Everyone knows that. The rabbi gave the drasha. So my man from my synagogue is too smart to accept that too easily. He goes to the rabbi after services and says, Rabbi, 3 years old? Who can carry all that water on her shoulder with her three? How can she carry camels? How could she decide to go get married? And what kind of person is Yitzchak Avinu if he marries a three-year-old girl? What would we think of someone today if they married a three-year-old girl? Very bizarre. So the rabbi looked him square in the eye and said, if you have those questions, you're an apikoros. It doesn't follow the party line. If Chazal say she was three, she was three. You have a question, you're out of the circle. We don't want you in anymore. You're an apikoros. He called me up shaking. Am I an apikoros? I said, no. Tell your rabbi to go to Yevamot 61b and find a Tosafot that says Rivka was 14 years old. Not that that's not so much better, but it's better than three. Yeah. When Chazal used the number three, it doesn't mean necessarily 3 years. They said Avraham Avinu discovered God when he was three. What does it mean? It means very unusual, precocious, tremendous. Like we say, it's a million years old. So someone 100 years from now is going to say that the Torah in motion, Rabbi Angel says something that's a million years old. How could he say that a million years old? Don't get so excited. They spoke in poetic language. We have to understand how they use their language and what context. And you're not apikoros if you accept the language in a more figurative way. That's exactly what Rambam was arguing. One more point on this before coming to a conclusion. I call it obscurantism. Obscurantism is people use the words of our sages as though they know what God thinks. So when we were in Israel last summer, during the Lebanon War, we thought the reason the war happened was because Hezbollah kidnapped some Israeli soldiers. That's what we thought. But we were probably wrong. Because the head of the Edah Haredit got up and said the reason that there's a war, and the reason our soldiers are getting killed, and the reason we're suffering so much, is because we didn't march in enough numbers against the gay parade in Jerusalem. That's a new one. He has an exact line from God knowing exactly why things happen. If that isn't enough, we had another statement by another great rabbi, this time a Sephardic rabbi, who said the reason there was a Holocaust is because of Reformed Jews. I'm not saying I understand, I don't understand what he's saying. I do understand that he should never have said such a thing. Because no matter what we might individually think or not think, we just don't really know what God says. I'm an angel and I don't even know. Right? Nobody has a right to dictate these kind of things and say it as though they're saying the word of God and expect people to listen to it. Well, they do say these things, and those things are accepted. And we have an extremism that is growing. So I want to go back now to Ma'amad Har Sinai, since that's where we all started together. God's voice came from heaven. According to the Midrash, the Torah was given, the revelation was in 70 languages. Why 70 languages? For all the nations of the world. Everyone should have access to the Torah. Very good. God said in the Torah, the people of the world will look at you and they'll say, Rak am chacham v'navon. What a wise and brilliant people the Jewish people are for following the words of the Torah. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me that when God gave us the Torah, he had great dreams for us. This little nation was supposed to take these words of God in an unprecedented and never-to-be-duplicated revelation, and bring these words not only to themselves, but to all the peoples of the world. What a tremendous mission. And then, how do you fulfill that mission? Let's say we skip now into not our century, but just a little bit further ahead of us. And then we have many people who think the way we fulfill the mission at Mount Sinai is to live in ghettos. Physical ghettos, mental ghettos, spiritual ghettos, intellectual ghettos. Torah is not strong enough to compete in the world. The Torah is not strong enough to teach to the rest of the world. It's not even strong enough to teach to our own children. We have to protect them and isolate them and build walls because the outside world is so bad. It's hard for me to believe, maybe you believe it, that when God gave us the Torah, that was his ambition, that the Torah should be confined and small and made more and more narrow. I don't think so. I think that as a community, as an Orthodox community, as a modern Orthodox community, even if we're not so modern, it doesn't even matter. There are certain key principles that we have to keep in mind. Respect for the individual's uniqueness. Respect for the right of each individual to say his piece and her piece and add to the conversation. Intellectual openness, the desire not to be restricted to the bed of Sodom. Jews are, amazingly, you'll be surprised to hear this one, Jews are human beings. We have all the feelings, all the emotions of every other human being. We have a responsibility to interact with all the human beings in the world. Some of the things I've heard over the course of these last few lectures and references to people of different religions and different races, they make my blood curdle. This is entirely antithetical to Judaism. Any racism or anti-anybody-ism is not part of the Jewish tradition. We love. We recognize the holiness of all people. We don't always like them, and they don't always like us. But it's different from disparaging people just because we don't have the same color or the same background or the same religion. Finally, non-authoritarianism. We've got to be able to develop a society that respects authority, but not authoritarianism. We have to have our leaders be authoritative, but not authoritarian. So someone was going to ask, oh, Rabbi Angel, these are really nice ideas, we subscribe to them, but what can we do to change the reality? The answer is we can do everything. That's what the answer is. The answer is we have kids in schools, and we can talk to our teachers and our principals. The answer is we contribute to all kinds of tzedakot. Do you check where your money goes, where your tzedakah is going? Do you put your tzedakah in big bulk in those things that you really support? Here's an assignment. Tonight, everyone go home and say five principles that are the core principles of your life and see how much money you contribute to each of those principles to make those things fostered. If we would all do that, we would find that we'll put much more of our financial, emotional, and intellectual energy into supporting those kind of things that we believe are good for the Jews and certainly good for the Orthodox Jews. I think it's important to support Torah in motion. I think that you've proved this today to me without any question. I took early retirement from my synagogue, even though the synagogue goes back to 1654, and I'm the eighth rabbi. Our son is now the ninth rabbi since 1768. The tradition is that a rabbi can go at least to age 70. So I'm still a youngster. I'm only 62. So I could have stayed another 8 years. I decided I have a good successor in place. I want my son to take over. But the other reason is because I'm so consumed by this problem of the narrowing of orthodoxy that I want to devote whatever years God gives me to try to spread the idea that orthodoxy is open, it's alive, it's creative, it's diverse. There's a lot of room for all of us. It's not a narrow road. It's a wide, beautiful, enriching road that makes all of us happier, that can be good for us, good for non-Orthodox Jews, good for non-Jews. We have a real message, an attractive message, a beautiful message. It can empower us and give us everything good. So I founded an institute called the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals. So I'm going to make one advertisement. We just opened a website called jewishideas.org. Visit us. See what we're doing. You'll see that a lot of things are in connection with what's doing here. And if all of us find things that we can do and devote ourselves to, financially support and support by our volunteerism, and by putting our ideas on the table and not letting them get shoved aside, and making sure people are invited even if they don't have the right opinions, then we are doing our share to push the thing back a little bit. Mashiach is not going to come right away necessarily. We're not going to be able to change the whole society in 2 weeks. But if each of us really took this as a serious mission and not just simply give up, I think we can win in the long run by stemming this tide of authoritarianism and pushing it back a little bit. And if we could do a little bit even in our lifetime, hopefully our children can pick up the task and things will swing back to a more normal orthodoxy. Good day and thank you again.
Thank you very much for really an inspiring talk. I think we often lose sight of the beauty within orthodoxy. You know, God forbid we should just sit and always be a critic. There is what to critique, but it's in a constructive way, and it's a really beautiful, beautiful way of life. But we all, is the essence of what we are, who we are, what we want to do. And I thank Rabbi Angel for putting it in such, you know, beautiful, eloquent words about the mission we have for ourselves, for our community, and for the world at large. And thank you very much.